Hi, this is Celtica Radio, and I'm Dave Carrington, welcoming you to another edition of Squaring the Circle, online, on mobile, and on your smart speaker. In the aftermath of COVID, I presented a series of 12 short fictional stories with an aviation or aerospace theme, some of which had a supernatural flavour. I'm pleased to announce that these have been compiled into a book which is available on Kindle. The book is called Battle Cry, and the cover illustration shows a formation of three fairy battle aircraft flying over the British countryside. The book is dedicated to Celtica Radio and is a symbol of the potential opportunities presented to all authors who have had their work read out on my show. The book's title story is available on the Celtica Radio archive for you to get a flavour of the whole of the book's content. The story this time is one of the stories contained within the book Battle Cry, and it's called Gemini 13. As most listeners will guess, the plot is space-based, but I'll make no further comment except to say that I sincerely hope you enjoy listening to it and attempted to stay tuned as the remaining stories are aired in the next few months. All I can say now is sit back and enjoy Gemini 13, read by my producer, Bill Everett, after these messages.
The fastest way to the internet.
islandwebservices.co.uk.
Island Web Services design and host bespoke websites for businesses and individuals. Professional websites start from just £100 with no hidden extras. Log on to find out more at islandwebservices.co.uk.
Buncherfarmers.com. We make the best all-natural stain remover on the planet. And for Celtica Radio listeners only, you can get 25% off any Buncher Farmers product by typing in the promo code Celtica when you order direct from our website. So that's promo code CELTICA to get 25% off any product at buncherfarmers.com.
I love Celtica Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Gemini 13, read by Bill Everett.
Inspector Fred Barrett of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police was perplexed. Summoned back from leave by his chief constable, he'd arrived at the Canadian Forces base Comox in British Columbia and found himself staring at an ever-expanding pool of water in the middle of a hangar that had been given over for his exclusive use. The focus of his attention was a regularly shaped dark metal object standing in the middle of the pool. The item had been found in the Edith Cavell Glacier, just off the Icefield Parkway to the east of the province, by a ranger who had been assessing the safety of the glacier for tourists following a calving event the previous day. The unknown nature of the object was such that the whole thing had been airlifted to Comox for further investigation. One end was circular and rather large, like a garbage pail, but its form had been scraped and crushed by the ice. However, this was attached to a large conical skirt made of a corrugated material. The surface was punctured by various apertures, and the whole thing was about 20 foot long and 10 feet in diameter at the widest part. Hanging awkwardly on one side was a couple of distorted wheels, whilst on the other side there were various wires leading to a mangled, kite-shaped frame covered with a canvas material. The whole thing was painted black, and whilst there had been a few markings on the side, they were too damaged and faded to read. Curiously, there were signs of scorching, as if the whole thing had been subjected to intense heat. Dressed in crime scene overalls, Barrett approached the object with a feeling of nervous excitement. The whole shape was that of a large, wide-necked funnel which lay on its side. To the rear was a dome-shaped heat shield which bore the scars of a high-speed re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. There was a hatch missing on one side. The cavity beneath was filled with glacial ice. Having taken copious photographs, Barrett's first job was to expose the craft in its entirety and cut away all extraneous additions. There was no time for an archaeological approach to this process, so he said, "Hand me those bolt croppers, please, Dan." Staff Sergeant Dan Drummond of the RCMP, who was standing alongside, did as he was bid. From the size and shape of this thing, Fred, I'm guessing it's an American spacecraft. Should we call them for assistance? Barrett began cutting away the wires, holding the kite rig in place. Hell no! Barrett's response was immediate and emphatic. This spacecraft, for want of a better description, was found in Canada. It's therefore a conundrum for us to solve. I've no doubt that the Americans will be involved sooner or later, but let's make it later. And in the meantime, this investigation will continue under a veil of secrecy until the time is right to reveal all. Now, let's get a hot air blower on this thing overnight to melt the rest of the ice. The following day, Barrett and Drummond returned, anxious to see what had been revealed overnight. As they approached the side of the vehicle beneath the missing hatch, they could see that the ice had virtually disappeared, and the dark compartment, so revealed, was empty. There was no seat. Barrett knelt down for a closer look, and immediately recoiled in horror. Dan, there's some guy in there. Sat in the right-hand seat of the spacecraft, an area still covered by a hatch, was a seated figure in a crumpled white spacesuit. The head was concealed in a white spherical helmet, and the face was covered by a dark visor. One hand was poised over a black and yellow handle that was attached to the seat. The other was over the visor, as if protecting the head, which was tilted away from Barrett and Drummond. Barrett spoke first. Poor guy. Let's get him out of there. They both began a search of the exterior of the craft, and soon found a handle which looked as if it opened the hatch. The handle was remarkably free to move, and the hatch swung open. Barrett and Drummond surged forward to examine the revealed body. It was immediately obvious that the corpse was female. Her spacesuit was discolored with age, but her life support, communication, and electrical connections were still in place. However, there were three things that made an immediate impact on both Barrett and Drummond. Firstly, printed on the back of the dead astronaut's seat was the inscription, Gemini 13. This, in turn, was embellished with the American flag. Secondly, stenciled on the dead astronaut's helmet were the letters CCCP. And lastly, there was a bullet hole in the dead woman's helmet immediately opposite her left temple. Wow, muttered Drummond. How the hell? Looks like we've got an unusual cold case, eh, Fred? I'm guessing it's murder. Barrett smiled at Drummond's ironic choice of words. I guess so. And I suppose we'd better start referring to her as a cosmonaut and not an astronaut. With the body removed for post-mortem examination, Barrett and Drummond continued their inspection of the Gemini 13 craft for clues which could explain the circumstances surrounding these mysterious events. The seat in which the cosmonaut was found turned out to be an ejection seat. The fact that there was no seat on the other side and the fact that there was no hatch panel in front implied that there had been another occupant and that person had ejected before touchdown. However objective the investigation, though, it seemed highly likely that whoever had occupied the left-hand seat had murdered the cosmonaut in the right-hand seat. Suddenly, Drummond grabbed Barrett's arm. Fred, you need to see this. He pointed his torch at the gap between the seat and the center console. I'm guessing it's the murder weapon. The torch beam had revealed the unmistakable shape of a small automatic pistol. With some difficulty, they managed to retrieve the gun. Drummond took a closer look. That's an old Colt automatic. The safety catches off, and by the weight, I'd say the magazine had rounds in it. Barrett took the gun, applied the safety catch, and placed it in an evidence bag. I agree. We need to remove the seat and find the spent cartridge case. But first, let's go and consider what we found so far. They retired to an office set aside for their use. Okay, Dan, let's start with a timeline. Get onto Google and find out when Gemini 13 was launched. I'll arrange for the seat to be removed. A few minutes later, Drummond turned to Barrett and tapped the computer screen. Now that's what I call a mystery. There were only 12 Gemini flights, 10 of which were manned, each by a two-man crew. The last flight was on the 11th of November, 1966. In other words, there was no Gemini 13 launch. It never existed, according to this, the NASA information website, and there were no further American launches at all until the start of the Apollo program the following year. What about Russian launches around this time? Well, the closest Soviet launch to the likely launch date of our enigmatic G-13 was the launch of the Russian unmanned 7K OK No. 2, or Cosmos 133. This experimental craft could accommodate between one and three cosmonauts, and it took off on the 28th of November 1966. However, according to the Russians, Cosmos 133 was unmanned and burned up on re-entry. Barrett rubbed his chin. This period is in the middle of the Cold War. I wonder. See if you can find a website which lists the American intercontinental ballistic missile test launches around this time. I seem to remember that the Titan II rocket was used by the Gemini craft and was a modified ICBM rocket. I suppose it's just possible that our Gemini 13 was a secret launch disguised as an ICBM test firing. Just then, Barrett's phone rang. It was the pathologist. Hi, Fred. Preliminary findings of the autopsy showed, as we suspected, that a Russian cosmonaut was killed by a 9mm bullet through the head, and at the moment, there's nothing to suggest any other cause. Time of death was difficult to calculate, bearing in mind the glacial ice factor, but the end of 1966 is certainly within the frame. Oh, and by the way, from her personal effects, it seems we have a name, Natalia Sandor, and she was wearing a ring on her wedding finger, so I'm guessing she was married. Barrett briefed Drummond on the autopsy report. Barrett pointed to the timeline on the whiteboard. Maybe this is a coincidence, but your hunch may be right, Fred. There was an ICBM test launch from the U.S. Air Force Space Command base at Vandenberg, California, and that was on, guess when? The 28th of November, 1966, the same day as the unmanned Cosmos 133. Obviously, there's no evidence to say they're connected, but I bet you 50 cents they are. Barrett picked up a marker pen and approached the whiteboard. Okay, so we have a Gemini 13 spacecraft. Why, when there were only 12 Gemini flights? My understanding is that all the Gemini flights landed in the ocean. Why then was this one embedded in a Canadian glacier? And why is there a primitive undercarriage and a kite-like apparatus attached to it? Drummond pointed to his computer screen. I have the answer to that question. NASA was experimenting with something called a Rugolo wing paraglider for a land recovery of the spacecraft instead of the usual parachute and sea recovery. It looks as though this was the system used on our G-13. But if that's so, why did G-13 land in Canada and not the USA? And why in a glacier? Barrett paused, deep in thought. Okay, moving on. Why is there only one astronaut in a capsule designed for two? And why did only one person eject? Why is the person left behind a Russian cosmonaut? Why was she shot? And who shot her? Barrett turned back to face Drummond. Did you examine the gun we found in the spacecraft? I think we can assume that this was the murder weapon, at least until we can prove otherwise. And by the way, did you find the spent cartridge case? Yes, it's in the evidence bag, and I haven't had a chance to check it for prints yet. Okay, we do need to do that rather quickly, and we need to check the pistol for prints and serial number to see if that gives us a steer as to who owns it. Barrett put down his marker pen. Let's move on. The left seat, which is now missing, was the commander's seat. He, or maybe she, must have been an astronaut trained in America. So I want you, Dan, to get the names of every astronaut trained up to the beginning of the Apollo program, whether they flew or not. When you've got that list, I want you to delete from all those who flew in the Apollo and subsequent programs. I'm guessing that those early Gemini ejection seats may have left those that used them with a rather weak back and therefore medically unable to take part in any further flights. This may be a wrong assumption, but at least it's a start, and we'll expand from there if we need to. Also, delete from the list all those who've died and see if you can get the contact details of those who are still alive. One or more of them may be aware of the Gemini 13. We may get lucky and find one that also practiced landing with the paraglider. Drummond looked up from his notebook. Okay, Fred. By the way, the pistol is clean of prints, and the serial number has been ground away. Barrett picked up the evidence bags containing the pistol and the spent cartridge case. I'll get these and the blood samples to the forensic lab in Vancouver by courier. See if we can get any leads. Drummond's painstaking analysis of the NASA records yielded 35 names of astronauts who had trained and flown up to the 28th of November 1966. As instructed, he reduced the list down to 15 names that had trained and not flown in the Apollo or subsequent programs. By eliminating those personnel who had died since training, only 5 names remained. Of those, he had managed to trace the contact details of 4. They either lived in Florida or Texas. In the guise of an investigative journalist writing an article on the training of early NASA astronauts, he had rung those for whom he had the contact details. While all seemed keen to contribute to his peripheral questions, none had heard of a Gemini 13 flight, and all claimed that whilst there had been paragliding experiments associated with the Gemini program, they claimed that this means of recovery had been discontinued because of control problems. Intriguingly, the fourth contact gave details of the astronaut who had tested the Rogolo wing. His name was Dean Chatley, an ex-CIA U-2 pilot, thought to be resident in the Sunseeker's Rest Home, Florida. Drummond immediately began a search for the Sunseeker's Rest Home, and straight away he found it, dialed a number, and his call was answered by a female, who introduced herself as Florence. "Hi, Florence. My name's Dan Drummond. I'm trying to contact one of your residents, Mr. Gene Chatley. Can you put me through to him, please?" "I'm afraid Mr. Chatley can't come to the phone right now. He's confined to a wheelchair. He'll be in the day room right now. Can I take a message?" "That's okay, Florence. I'll be in the area soon and may pop in to see him, if that's okay. By the way, what does Mr. Chatley like to drink?" Barrett's cell phone rang. "Hi, Fred. This is Dr. Carl McDowell at the Police Forensic Lab in Vancouver. We've done some preliminary analysis on your evidence, and I think we've got something for you to work with. First of all, the bullet that killed your victim did come from the Colt 9mm pistol you sent to us. There were 6 bullets in the magazine. 5 of them, together with a spent case you gave us, were clean of prints, except for the last round, from which I got a pretty good thumbprint. I'll email it to you. There were no prints in the gun itself, but by acid etching, we were able to determine the obliterated serial number. From this, we could tell that the gun was one of a small quantity that was issued to the US government. Furthermore, because relatively few of these guns were made in this range, we're guessing it was issued either to the FBI or the CIA. From the blood sample, I can tell you that the person from which it was extracted was female and that she was pregnant by a couple of months. Even in the short term available to us, we were able to complete a DNA test. It appears that the woman from whom the blood was taken was a close relative of a US citizen by the name of Nikolai Sandor. My guess would be that this Sandor is the son of your victim. Nikolai Sandor is the leading light in a Russian mafia syndicate based in Miami, Florida. I've put together a file on him for your information. He's done time in jail for drug offenses. That's how we've got his DNA details from the US to match those of your victim. The file is on its way to you by courier, together with all the other items you sent to me. Barrett hung up and turned to Drummond. So what do we got? Very interesting. There were rumors of a Gemini 13 flight, but this has been discounted by all the astronauts I've spoken to. However, I managed to locate a guy called Gene Chatley. He's still alive, but only just by the sound of it. I'm guessing he must be in his late 80s or 90s, and so, if we're going to link him with our inquiries, we should do it soon. He's astronaut trained, but allegedly never flew. He was, however, the lead test pilot in the Rogolo Wing paraglider experiments, and, it's alleged, he was a CIA pilot who flew U-2 spy planes. Good work, Dan. As a matter of fact, I may have a CIA link to the Colt pistol we found. There's also a thumbprint on a 9mm cartridge case in the magazine. Now, wouldn't it be convenient if that were to be Chatley's print? Now, Fred, I sense a visit with a view to entrapment. Not at all, Dan, Barrett smiled. But do you know what? This investigation is getting me down and I need a break. I really fancy a flight to Tampa tomorrow. Can you set that up for me, please? And while I'm there, I might just give Mr. Chatley a visit. Okay, but take a bottle of bourbon with you. It's his favourite liquor. The following day, Barrett, in the guise of an investigative journalist, met Dean Chatley in the day room of the Sunseekers' Rest Home in Sanibel Island. The old man was slouched in a wheelchair. After brief and cordial introductions had been exchanged, Barrett took out his list of pre-prepared questions. Thank you for agreeing to see me at such short notice. I happen to be in the area, and I and my colleague are writing an article on the training of early NASA astronauts involved in the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions. Tell me, sir, what did you do before joining the astronaut training program? Chatley's lackluster gaze sparked momentarily at the opportunity to reminisce. He shifted and leaned forward. I learned to fly with the Navy when I left college, and I flew from carriers during the Korean War. Afterwards, I became a civilian pilot. Before we go any further, Mr. Chatley, can I stand you a drink? I just happen to have with me a bottle of bourbon, which I'll leave with you as a gift for agreeing to see me. Chatley nodded his agreement, and Barrett fumbled clumsily in his bag for the large bottle and a couple of glasses, which he filled with generous measures of the liquor before handing one to Chatley. Now, Mr. Chatley, were you ever employed by the CIA? Chatley's eyes narrowed, and his whole expression turned immediately to one of suspicion. Whatever made you think that? Barrett suspected that he wouldn't get very far with that line of questioning, so he changed the subject. When did you qualify as an astronaut? That would be around September 1964. All I had to do then was to wait for a flight. Did you ever get a Gemini spacecraft? The Gemini crews were all listed on the NASA website. You won't see my name on that list. There were rumours of a Gemini 13 flight. What can you tell me about that? There was a long, significant pause while Chatley settled back with his drink. Barrett resumed. Sir, were you aware of a Gemini 13 flight? I'm getting tired, Mr. Barrett, and I need to rest. With that, he switched on his electric wheelchair and turned toward the door. But to answer your question, there was no Gemini 13 craft or flight. Barrett moved quickly to face Chatley. Sorry to tire you, sir, but one more question, if I may. The NASA website shows a Gemini land recovery system using a Rogolo kite-shaped paraglider. I understand from one of your colleagues that you were the test pilot charged with trialing this system. Was it ever used in practice? Again, Chatley's eyes glazed with mistrust and irritation. Yes, it's true. I did flight test the Rogolo paraglider recovery system for the Gemini spacecraft. One might even say that I perfected it. But I crashed it in the final stages of testing and seriously damaged my back. That's why you see me in this goddamn wheelchair, and that's why I'm in this awful place. Again, to answer your question, it was never used operationally. It was very difficult to control. Now, I'm sorry, Mr. Barrett, but I really must rest. Goodbye. With that, and clutching the bourbon bottle, he left the day room. Carefully, Barrett collected Chatley's whiskey glass and poured the remains of the liquor into the Sunseeker glass. He placed the now empty glass he'd brought from Comox carefully into an evidence bag and stowed it in his attaché case. 2 days later, back at Comox, he was met by Drummond, wearing a broad smile. Fred, the thumbprint on Chatley's whiskey glass matches the one we found on the cartridge case. Chatley's our man. Got to be. Barrett was more circumspect. Okay, we've now got facts mixed up with coincidences. I think it's time we brigade these and see what our next move should be. He approached the whiteboard. Natalia Sandor was killed by a 9mm bullet. Fact. The cartridge case of one of the bullets found in the murder weapon has Chatley's thumbprint on it. Fact. Chatley was a trained astronaut who claims he never flew. He also perfected the Rogolo paraglider land recovery system of the Gemini capsule. Both facts. The paraglider recovery system is evident on the G-13 capsule. Fact. There was only one seat in the G-13 capsule, the commander's seat, which had been used for ejection. Fact. Early ejection seats could cause debilitating back problems, and Chatley says he has a chronic back injury. I think we'll mark that one down as a coincidence. There was a Titan II rocket launch on the same day that the unmanned Russian Cosmos 133 was launched. Coincidence. Cosmos 133 was destroyed on re-entry. Fact. Lastly, Chatley was alleged to have worked for the CIA, and it's probable that the gun that killed Natalia was a CIA weapon. Coincidence? Okay, so how do we tie this lot together and move on with our investigation? We must surely go back and confront Chatley with these facts and demand an explanation. With any luck, he'll come clean and admit the whole thing. Of course, the biggest mystery remains to be solved. What was a Russian cosmonaut doing on board an American Gemini spacecraft? Just then the phone rang. Barrett picked up the receiver. Fred, this is Craig the pathologist. We've completed our post-mortem on Natalia Sandor. The only thing left is a formal identification. If push comes to shove, I guess we could use the DNA association that Vancouver has revealed. But do you have any suggestions as to how we could improve on that and close down the paperwork? No, Craig, I suspect that that may be the only solution. The Russians will never admit that one of their own was found in an American spacecraft. He paused in mid-sentence, just as a thought occurred to him. Hang on a minute, I'll get back to you. Just keep her body in the morgue for a little longer. He hung up and opened the file sent to him by McDowell in Vancouver, annotated the whiteboard with the relevant information, and dialed a number in Miami. Chatley's surprise and irritation were obvious as soon as Barrett confronted him for the second time. Mr. Chatley, I must confess to you a slight deception on my part. I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm an inspector with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and I'm investigating the murder of a Russian cosmonaut by the name of Natalia Sandor. He switched on his mini disc recorder and placed it on the table in front of Chatley. So why have you come here? Chatley's face was twisted with anger and fear. I know nothing about any Russian cosmonaut, and I certainly didn't shoot her. That's very interesting, Mr. Chatley. I never said she'd been shot. You said she'd been murdered. I assumed she'd been shot. Anyway, you're a Canadian. You have no legal jurisdiction here. Get out. Chatley's voice cracked and his breathing showed signs of panic. You're right, of course. And if I leave here, I'll go straight to your FBI with some very compelling evidence against you. If you cooperate with me, however, I will reserve judgment. What I want right now is the truth. Chatley remained silent. Barrett continued. You were working for the CIA. You were a U-2 spy plane pilot, and you trained as an astronaut. You flew a clandestine mission in Gemini 13 on the 28th of November 1966. With a Russian cosmonaut, whom you subsequently shot in the head. We know this because we have the gun you used, and there's a cartridge in the magazine with your thumbprint on it. You murdered Natalia Sandor. We need to know how she came to be in your spacecraft and why you shot her. Tell me, Mr. Chatley, what happened on your mission of the 28th of November, 1966? Chatley remained silent. Barrett waited for a minute or so before continuing. Have it your way, Mr. Chatley. I'm now going to the FBI. Maybe they can get you to answer these questions, eh? He picked up his attaché case and recorder. As he opened the door to leave, Chatley spoke. His voice was thin, with a whisper. Was she pretty? What did you say? Natalia. Was she pretty? I never saw her full face. Astounded by the implications of this unexpected turn of events, Barrett stopped, turned back towards Chatley, and flicked the recorder switch back to on. Okay, Dean, do you want to tell me what happened? First of all, tell me how you found Natalia, he croaked. Barrett explained the circumstances of Natalia Sandor's discovery and gave a brief outline of what he and Drummond had discovered. When he'd finished, Chatley slumped back in his chair. I'm an old man, Inspector. I have a life expectancy of less than 6 months, and there's nothing you or the FBI can do to change that. I'm already on death row in this overpriced institutional cage. The only difference between this and the prison is that I get to choose what I eat and when to sleep. Yes, I was employed by the CIA, and just because I was working for them doesn't mean that I don't have a conscience. I've killed a few people in my time, but Natalia was different. Orders are orders, but then again, wasn't that the justification of the Nazi henchmen at the Nuremberg trials? I know that doesn't excuse what I did or make the memory any less distressing. Barrett leaned a little closer to Chatley. Tell me what happened, Dean. You know there was a Gemini 13 flight. You were the commander, weren't you? Yes, there was a Gemini 13 flight, and yes, I was the commander. But it was unlike any Gemini flight that had gone before. We took off from Vandenberg Air Force Base on the pretext of an ICBM test launch. I was alone in the left seat. The Titan II rocket couldn't launch with two pilots and the Rogolo gear. It would have been too heavy. My launch was to be timed on the same day as the Cosmos 133 spacecraft, which took off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome launch site in Kazakhstan. The Russians announced that Cosmos 133 was an unmanned mission, but I guess they didn't want to waste a launch like that, whatever the risk, and so Natalia was on board alone to undertake some flight testing. What they didn't know was that gave her the perfect opportunity to defect, something she decided she wanted to do for a long time. In September 1962, President Kennedy committed NASA to landing men on the moon. This was all very well, but our control and guidance systems were too primitive in the extreme for that kind of mission. There's more computing power on a modern-day greetings card than was available for the moonshot. On the other hand, the Russians had proved that they could go to the moon with their Luna 10 unmanned spacecraft, which achieved lunar orbit after its launch on the 3rd of April 1966. What we needed was access to their computer software, which enabled them to do that. Natalia agreed to steal the software, provided we would allow her and her close relatives to defect to the United States before the flight. We agreed, but we found out later that her entire family was corrupt and masterminding a large mafia organization in Russia. They were on the brink of discovery by the KGB. Basically, we wanted the software, but we didn't want her or her family. It was difficult for her to escape from Russia carrying the software, so she took a copy with her on the Cosmos 133 flight. My mission was to rendezvous with her in space and allow her to spacewalk across to the Gemini 13 capsule. It really was that simple. We placed a small amount of explosives in the Cosmos 133, and after it exploded, the wreckage burned up in the atmosphere, just as the Russians had announced. They obviously thought that Natalia had been killed in the explosion, and that she too had burned up on re-entry. For Natalia, it was the perfect defection. We couldn't risk an ocean recovery for Gemini 13. This was a secret mission, and we didn't want an entire ship's company to know about it. That's why we decided to use the Rogolo paraglider wing option. As I had perfected its use, I was the obvious choice to be the commander for the mission. Unfortunately, after re-entry, there was a malfunction with the wing. It wouldn't deploy when it should have, and so I ejected with the necessary software over Washington State. That's the reason my back is so painful. From what you say, it would appear that the wing then deployed of its own accord, and the resulting uncontrolled flight brought Gemini down in the Canadian Rockies. That's the last anyone saw Gemini 13 or Natalia, until, as you say, the spacecraft was released from the glacier, where it must have landed and become entombed for 50 or so years. As instructed, I shot Natalia just before I ejected. I regret that. I regret that a lot. I still have nightmares about it. But I did manage to retrieve the software from her. Mission accomplished, eh? And that, Inspector, is it. Except to say that Apollo 8 and all the subsequent Apollo moon flights were programmed with the Russian software or refined derivatives of it. And the rest, as they say, is history. Barrett was speechless. The story was so unbelievably fantastic, It had to be true. He stared at his notes, shuffling them idly. His mind was racing. Chatley broke the silence. "I ask again, Inspector. Natalia. Was she pretty? All I ever saw of her was her smile, and that she had the most beautiful, deep blue eyes." "Yes. Even after 50 years preserved in the ice, she was still very pretty, and she was pregnant." Barrett met Nikolai Sandor, a graying man in his late 50s, at Vancouver International Airport and drove him immediately to Comox. "You say my mother was murdered? Who did this?" His accent was thickly Balkan. "You will understand that the law must take its course, and I cannot tell you that or indeed anything else that may jeopardize our investigation." "I don't care about laws. This was my mother we are discussing, and I want to know who did this." "As I explained, Mr. Sandor, I cannot tell you. What I can say is that your mother was in the very early stages of pregnancy." Sandor turned to stare at Barrett. The look in his face was frighteningly malevolent. Once in the morgue, Sandor barged into the room where his mother was lying on a stainless steel post-mortem table. He drew back the sheet to reveal her face and tenderly stroked her forehead. He examined her wound closely for what seemed like an age before turning to leave. "Yes, that is my mother, Natalia Sandor. I will arrange for her body to be collected, and she will be buried in the presence of my family. Now I wish to see the spacecraft in which she was found. I also need coffee and 2 smoke. He marched out of the morgue into the sunshine, with Barrett hurrying to keep up with him. "The area is still a crime scene, and I don't think we can..." "Take me there now, Inspector. I insist." Barrett shrugged his shoulders and sighed loudly. He took out his cell phone and called Drummond. "Dan, sterilize the hangar crime scene. I'm bringing Sandor over to see the G-13. A few minutes later, Barrett led Sandor into the Gemini 13 hangar. He was pleased to see that Drummond had turned their whiteboards to the wall and taped off the Gemini capsule area. "Now I need coffee." Sandor pointed to the kitchen annex. "Coffee, this way." He didn't wait for a reply. "You stay here. I will always bring my special coffee with me. I make it a Russian way. You will enjoy, I know." He went to the kitchen. 2 minutes later, he emerged with 3 cups of steaming black coffee. He passed the cups around and sat down in a lawn chair. "So tell me again, how did you find my mother?" Barrett began to repeat the details of how the Gemini 13 spacecraft was discovered, but after a few minutes, the atmosphere in the hangar seemed to relax and swirl. The coffee was indeed delicious. Many hours later, Barrett awoke with a serious headache. "Oh, my head. What's happened? What time is it?" It was dark outside. Barrett looked around and was seized with urgency as he saw that the tape surrounding the Gemini capsule had been broken. Their cabinets had been emptied onto the floor, their computers and phones smashed, and the whiteboards turned and wiped clean. More worryingly, the murder weapon had been taken. He staggered to his feet, glanced at the hangar clock, and still holding his head, he shook Drummond vigorously. Dan, wake up. We've been out for hours, maybe even a day or so. Sandor drugged us, and he's trashed the place. He's taken the gun, and from the whiteboards he will have discovered it was Chatley that murdered his mother and unborn sibling. We have got to notify the nursing home and the Florida State Police. I'm guessing he's headed there. Barrett eventually managed to find the Sunseeker nursing home phone number. His call was answered by an authoritative male voice. Barrett introduced himself. "This is Inspector Barrett of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, calling from Vancouver. I have reason to believe that one of your residents, Mr. Dean Chatley, is in grave danger, and..." "Hold it right there, sir. This is Lieutenant Dunhill of the Florida State Police." A middle-aged man forced his way into Mr. Chatley's room and fired a single shot, at close range, through his left temple. "We've got the murder weapon. It looks like an old Colt 9mm automatic. Military issue. You obviously know something about this. We need to talk."
And so we wrap up for this month another edition of Squaring the Circle here on Celtica Radio. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Gemini 13. My particular thanks go to Bill Everett for his excellent rendition of the story. Just a reminder that Gemini 13 is one of the stories in the book Battle Cry, a compilation of 12 fictional aviation stories presented on my show. Battle Cry is available on Kindle. Now, I know I keep saying this, but I always need new and original stories for Squaring the Circle. So, if you're a writer, or even an aspiring writer, and want to get your material on this programme, please send it in a Word-compatible document to dave.carrington@celticaradio.com. It can be fiction of any genre and up to a length of around 3,500 words. If you would prefer, send me a recording of it. Don't worry too much about the final background tweaks. We can get those sorted here at the station. You've been listening to Celtica Radio, the world's local radio station. And whatever time it is in your world right now, this is Dave Carrington wishing you all a very good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night.